From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 647, Does Windows Matter? With guest Paul Thurrott. Recorded Monday, May 27th, 2019. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts LLC. For more information, visit soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brendan. This is Richard Campbell. Thanks for listening to Run As Radio. And I'm bringing back my friend Paul Thurrott, who is an award-winning technology journalist. Who knew?
Wow. Fine.
Whenever I do talk about you, what I say is you are remarkably productive.
Yeah.
Like, you write a lot. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting about that statement is it in no way hints at any sense of quality.
Well, I wasn't going to go there.
Right. So if what you're looking for is word churn, yeah, I can do that.
You can do that part. I don't know. I'm a premium subscriber. I read your stuff.
Well, thank you.
But there's some insight there. I do think you work hard at what you do, and it's still important. It's just funny. I think Windows is moving.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you kind of hooked your boat to Windows pretty hard there a few years ago, friend.
I know. I used to say this all the time back when I was still at Windows IT Pro, which of course itself changed names many times, as you know. Mm-hmm. If I could have done anything differently professionally, I would have never named my site after Windows.
Right.
Right. Not because, I mean, look, Windows is still my focus, my primary focus. I love Windows. I still prefer Windows. I use all platforms. I mean, I don't mean to demean it in any way, but it was somewhat limiting for sure.
Yeah. Well, what was the old name? The Windows Supersite?
Yeah, Supersite for Windows.
Yeah.
You know, which was purchased by Duke Communication back in 1999, which was at the time the publishers of what was still called Windows NT Magazine.
Right. Remember when there were magazines?
I remember that. Well, I almost said fondly. I do remember that.
Yeah.
I will say, from the perspective of someone on the other side of the magazine, there was an incredible and multi-layer editorial process that went into every single article that I ever wrote that appeared in the magazine. And it was a bit strenuous, although I think you could make a good argument for the need for that kind of journalism or that kind of quality anyway today, for sure.
Yeah, the process that goes into really, you know, when you're going to commit stuff to paper and it costs money to do so.
Yep.
And now that it's just electrons, everything's just electrons, we kind of can just put it out there and hope for the best or and nothing else, correct as we go. Seems to be how they're building software these days.
Exactly. There's nothing, well, like a magazine is how many pages, but you could put out a book that is 500, 600, 800, 1,000 pages.
Right.
And when that mistake is made, that's committed to some print run of some thousands.
It's terrible. And they're going to be out there forever, and there's nothing you can do about it. And maybe you'll correct it in a reprint if there's a reprint.
That's right. And listen, I more than most people, I really enjoy when people confront me and say, "You said," you know, accusingly.
Yes. Because you once said.
I did. Yeah. I probably said lots of things.
And arguably, you change your mind, too. Like, stuff evolves.
Yeah, I'm not allowed to do that. Pretty much have to stay the path.
You have to be right forever.
That's right.
I'm trying to figure out. It's been challenging to do shows about Windows on Run As.
Yeah.
There's fewer people that want to talk about it, which I found really interesting.
Oh, this is all I want to talk about. So maybe this is ideal.
Yeah.
Because I have been semi-obsessed of late. I'm not a developer. I assume people understand that. I was a developer. I have a developer background. I've written several books about developer topics. These are all a million years ago, so I'm not completely up to date. But that background has really guided my relationship with Microsoft and allows me to have conversations with the company that are on a slightly different level than, say, a typical blogger or reporter, because I do somewhat understand the technical issues and what's going on with that stuff. So I've always been fascinated by the programming languages, the programming environments, the frameworks, the platforms, you know, and .NET in particular. But with the modern era, which is suddenly not so modern anymore. This move to kind of a mobile app platform and a mobile app store inside of Windows, you know, and how that's gone and how it's evolved. And it really is kind of an obsession for me, I would say, these days.
It is a strange world now. The past five, 6 years, which by stock market perspectives have been very good years for Microsoft.
Right.
The question
with
is
zero
is that,
regard to Windows.
Yeah. But do you see that as more the shift to the cloud is what has moved Microsoft so well.
Yeah. So I'm not an economist. I'm not a financial analyst, but I do know from my, you know, decades of reading up on the companies in the computer industry that I care about, that it is a very common occurrence where a company is pushing the next big thing. It's all it ever talks about. Mm-hmm. And what's really making the money in the background is this thing they don't want to talk about, which is the legacy business. I always use Apple as the example of this. In the 1980s, they really wanted the Mac to take off. And the Mac did not really take off for several years in any meaningful way. And from 1983 or 4 and it's through the late 80s when desktop publishing finally happened, it was the Apple II that was making all the money for Apple.
Yeah, and they didn't talk about the machine.
Market that or talk about it or, you know, whatever. And today, it's not fair to say that all the money is going through Windows, but Windows is the biggest single business inside of Microsoft, for sure. They don't talk about that.
No. And really, they've done a good job of hiding it in their corporate reporting. It's really hard to tell how the company makes money.
I think when something is so consistent, and Windows has been incredibly consistent, despite the fall of the PC industry in some ways, you almost take it for granted. You know, at least Microsoft does, I think, and shareholders do in the stock market, outside onlookers of all kinds. I mean, for me personally, it's still the focus, but I think it's important for everyone to understand that Windows is like an ATM machine. It sits there and churns out money. I mean, it's really never stopped.
And yet, is it growing?
Oh, that's an interesting question. No, probably not. And I have to say probably because one thing that Microsoft has done and following in the footsteps of other corporations in the United States and completely legally is they hide where revenues and profits are coming from in these obscure business units, right? So Microsoft has stopped reporting.
Well, when we talked about this last time you were on, which was a year ago.
Things like license sales of Windows and
about how they split the Windows team into two pieces. So literally, there's two completely different business units that nominally own parts of Windows. Like, I don't know how you...
It's incredible. Yeah, and if you even to extrapolate past that, there's just when you look at Microsoft's quarterly earnings or their annual earnings, they always talk about this thing called the commercial cloud. There is no such thing as the commercial cloud. The commercial cloud is a cherry-picked set of businesses from around Microsoft's actual businesses that comes up to some number and they can show some kind of a growth. You have no idea what goes into it.
Right.
You don't know if it changes from quarter to quarter, but what they want is something that they can present as a number, as growth, and they can say, hey, look, you know, there's this other thing called AWS. There's this other thing called Google, and we compare favorably.
Right. And of course, AWS and Google are concealing their numbers also.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, the only thing I know about for sure about Microsoft is they make money in lots of different ways. Where, I mean, we're all pretty convinced that Google only makes money on search.
Well, and I would say advertising, right? Yeah. So that number, it's interesting. That number's actually gone down. Off the top of my head, I won't be able to come up with an accurate figure, but at one point it was 97% of their revenues. And I think today, I want to say it's a low 80%. So they're starting to make a little bit of money from enterprise services or from consumer services that people are actually paying for. But yeah, the vast majority of that money comes from search / advertising. You know, Apple, the iPhone, again, not off the top of my head, I'm not going to give the exact number, but 60-something to 70-something percent of their revenues derived from the iPhone. If you add in services, because let's face it, 90% of those services are only because someone has an iPhone.
Right.
It becomes 90% of that business. Mm-hmm. You know, by comparison, Microsoft is incredibly diverse.
Yeah.
And that allows them to withstand the failure of individual businesses or the downfall or whatever of particular businesses in a way that, you know, some of these other companies might get hurt really badly.
And we're not talking about Windows failing per se, because it is use all over the place.
You know, unfortunately, in my line of business, which basically is pontificating, I guess, there's a lot of people taking what I say to be literal, you know. And so when you say something like, you know, the PC market is falling, which it is, doesn't mean it's disappearing.
No.
You know, Windows doesn't just disappear overnight. You know, the Titanic didn't sink in you know, 10 seconds or whatever. These things, they take some time. Not that Windows is a Titanic. I'm sorry. That's a terrible example. But, you know, Rome didn't, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. Everyone knows that phrase. You know, Rome wasn't torn down in a day either.
Right.
These things take time. And it doesn't mean it completely disappears. I you know, PCs, it's incredible. They evolved from being a very, you know, almost enthusiast business tool to being a central tool to everyone's lives. And then mobile happened. And now it's kind of gone back to its roots in some ways. You've got gamers who are extreme gamers who prefer the PC. And then people who just need the bigger screen keyboard for that productivity scenario. They're not doing all that other stuff that we right. used to do on PCs. And as a kind of a PC slash Windows enthusiast, I have to say, I like this world, you know? And so, yeah, it's a little smaller, you know, than it was maybe.
But it seemed like the tablet wave came in the tens, and I'm not saying it fizzled so much as it evened out, and so did the PC market.
Yeah.
Like we split up chunks of the market, and they've, you know, nobody's rapidly dying and nobody's rapidly growing. We still need to do compute. We're still doing compute.
That's right. Yeah. The smartphone market has flattened out nicely. The tablet mm-hmm. market is basically flattened out. The tablet market never overtook the PC market like many had predicted. And, you know, maybe this is where we sit for a little while. I mean, there's other stuff that's happening around ambient computing and smart speakers and stuff like that. But as far as, compute, I mean, you know, my computer setup and yours too, I would imagine, is a lot simpler than it was, you know, 10 years ago. And I like that a lot.
Yeah.
And I like that it's a purpose-driven device.
I'm a hardware guy. So I still do the shade tree mechanic thing of building my own machines, which is really anomalous these days. So I have several computers that I use on a routine basis. Although, let's be honest, like, it's the Surface Book Pro 2 that's used every day, no matter what I'm doing.
Sure.
That's sort of where it's gotten to now, right? Is that these are the machines. And apparently, I'm an anomaly. I can do a fair bit on my phone, but I can't tell you how many times I've futzed with my phone for a while and go, I'm going to wait till I get back to my big machine.
Yes. Maybe this is generational. I look at my kids and they're just, you know, they do things on the phone that I don't understand. I'm not capable of doing. I literally as recently as last night complained out loud to no one in particular because nobody cares that I still can't type on a phone for some reason. You know, despite, what is it now, over 10 years?
Our fingers are getting less accurate and our eyes are getting blurrier. And so, yeah, I miss a lot.
Yeah, I if it's important it's going to happen on the PC. I'm not going to book a flight. I'm not going to book an Airbnb. I'm not going to sign a contract. I'm not going to write a story on, you know, whatever, on a phone. I'm just not. I need to, and maybe I'm just old fashioned, but. Mm-hmm. I need the PC.
Yeah. But I don't think you're going to have trouble finding a PC ever. This just seems like a computational device that has a substantial niche. And while it may have took a hit when tablets first came along, you know, tablets have sort of leveled off too. If you talk about a shrinking market, look at the tablet market.
Exactly. I think that the PC has benefited and will continue to benefit from some of the things that these other platforms got right. Mm-hmm. And it's always kind of interesting what works and what doesn't work. You know, voice control of smart assistants is something that we kind of take for granted around the home in many ways, or in a car perhaps, on our phone. And for some reason, that didn't really kind of work on a PC. You know, the whole multi-touch tablet, smart pen thing. For some people, especially creatives, that stuff works really great. For a lot of people, it's like, well, you know, I really
don't touch my monitor.
I don't really need it.
Yeah. I'm pretty happy with my mouse.
You know, it depends.
Yeah, it definitely depends on the working scenario. But I think I think touch has just merged into our lives now. We're just used to being able to do that.
It's just another way. Yeah. And if you really think about it, I don't know you particular or anyone listening to this, but I find myself sometimes on a laptop just scrolling through an article on the web using my finger instead of the mouse or the arrow keys or whatever.
Because it's actually a more efficient motion.
Yeah. Yeah. And and the way you can kind of go back and forth between those, your mouse, trackpad, whatever you have, keyboard and touch is nice. And it speaks to the versatility of the machine. For me personally, I'm not going to pick up a pen and do that or pick up a pen and do anything. It's just the way I am. For some people, that's something too that they might add into that list, but for me, it's just not.
No, and I tried a bunch of times to make the pen work for me, and it eventually just, well, it helps. Yeah. It helps that my handwriting is shocking.
Yeah, after, and let's see, oh God, for, I'm not, maybe not quite 40 years, yes. 30-something years of using a computer and typing, my handwriting is terrible. I often joke, and it's not a joke. This is literally true in this case. I can't. My handwriting can't withstand the amount of writing it takes to write out a check. You know, like by the time I get to the end, my hand is all cramped up.
What's a check?
Yeah, right. Sorry. Again, for people listening, I'm old. We used to watch them on the talkies.
Yes, that's
it. Send it via telegram.
It's a check.
What's a check?
Oh, man. My goodness. I got to take a break for 1 second here, Paul.
This episode of Run As Radio is brought to you by the Humanitarian Toolbox. Humanitarian Toolbox builds open source software for disaster relief organizations. One of the leading projects, called Already, focuses on getting volunteers into the right place at the right time using cloud and mobile technology. HTBox builds and operates this and other applications on behalf of a variety of disaster response organizations, and they need your help. Go to htbox.org for more information or to make a tax-deductible donation. HTBox is a 501c3 U.S. registered charity.
And we're back. It's Richard Campbell. It's Run As Radio. And I'm talking to my friend Paul Thurrott. And you know, we're always going to have desktop machines, or at least some of us are going to have desktop machines. Some of us can live on phones, and that's fine. And maybe some of us can live on tablets, and that's fine. It's the servers I ask a question about. Like, the other number I'd like to see is, are the number of servers going up? Because now I think Microsoft is disincented to sell servers. They want to sell you cloud.
Well, that's convenient.
Yeah.
Because there was always, you know, I think there was an assumption, we'd have to go back now, probably to the early 2000s. That Microsoft's share of the what we'll call the on-premises or the traditional server market was just going to keep going up, you know, and maybe it should have been obvious at the time, but you can always tell when Microsoft talks about things in certain ways that maybe the broader story isn't as positive. And then in this sense, what I mean is they would talk about, well, in the Fortune 500 or in the Fortune 100, we have great share there, you know. The broader world, I think, was going in a different direction. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I think this is a direction that sweeps the client as well. I think this is all interrelated, but and plays into what we were talking about a little bit earlier, which is, you know, Windows becoming less of an emphasis in general, not just on the server, but on the client as well.
Right. And it took me, I mean, in theory, they shipped Server 2019 in October.
Right.
And right away, I'm looking, October 2018, right away, I'm looking for, well, then when are we upgrading? Like, what's the story here? And it wasn't until this spring.
Yep. This week.
That I was able to sit.
As we record this, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. I was able to find the folks that had done installations under contract or in their own premises and so forth to say, yeah, you can move to 2019. This is what you get. This is what you like, what you don't like that, those conversations. That's a long time. It was very interesting to see how carefully. And then the first question is, like, are you just upgrading because you have the license and you should upgrade? Or are you actually going after any new features? Like, are these features important to you in any way?
I was just evaluating this latest version of Server, and it's very interesting to me how light it is on new features, right? And that you know, on Server as well, you can see this in client a little bit too. They're starting to decouple things a bit. So the new admin center is separate in many ways from the OS in the sense that it's being developed separately and it's on its own little schedule, has its own version number, which is different from Server, which is very strange to me. You know, the way that Server Core has evolved, there is an understanding that for many environments, this really basic setup is perhaps too basic, and they have extensions you can add that bring back a bunch of the popular admin tools, including now for things like Hyper-V. Mm-hmm. Very interesting, you know. More and more, I think traditional on-prem server is almost the specialty install.
Yeah.
And, there's been a real change in not just the enterprise, I think in business overall, but especially in the enterprise, where these giant infrastructures were built out for what were probably very good reasons at the time. And then a decade or plus into it, you realize, what are we doing here? You know, we're spending all this time and money on infrastructure and not on whatever our business is.
Right.
You know, and I think that's the appeal of the cloud.
But also that an alternative product came along. You know, we used to run our businesses without the machines at all. And then gradually we added them in and added them in and added them in. Now this is service out there. It's like, it is super hard to justify running your own mail server, dude. Like, come on.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. But I don't know, 15 years ago ish, that was what everyone was pushing. And
well, they used to have small business server, right? I mean, Microsoft literally made a product that was your Exchange server and your database and your SharePoint site, your collaboration and document management tool that you ran on a couple of machines in your small operation.
I know, it's funny. The promise of small business server is basically the promise of the cloud today, which is,
yes,
you know, you don't really need anyone technical in your office to handle this. It's, well, actually, yeah, you do.
You do.
Well, yeah, and you know, but you don't need the giant team of
people. Yeah, my favorite shows around that were these folks that were third party, but they had a dozen, two dozen clients that they did the IT for in SBS.
Right.
And it's just, those were really neat conversations about, because they focused on automation. Right? They can only put so much attention to so many clients. And so how do they make sure that they just keep operating cleanly? And now you get that per seat out of Office 365.
You know, when you think about what was the pushback against the cloud, not including things like regulatory and legal requirements, right? Which is, you know, obvious in different industries. But the pushback was from the people who had made careers out of managing Exchange Server, whatever it was, and were managing version upgrades over time, you know, skipping every other version, however they did it. But the other half is what you just touched on, which is that partner ecosystem. And this was like, you know, one of Microsoft's greatest strengths. They created an entire ecosystem for solutions partners to come in and basically fix the problems that they created, you know. And it's kind of tough when you move to the cloud. How do you include these folks, right? I mean, a lot of them are basically getting one-time bonuses for moving people to Office 365 or probably Microsoft 365 today.
And then in theory, they're done. Like, I think there's still some care and feeding. Maybe the ratio gets higher now. Yeah. They can take care of a lot more people if they've done it correctly. But I also think, yes, by the time SBS first came out, which was in 2010 or something, Windows itself was a very mature product.
Yep.
And Office 365 just isn't. So at the same time that where, you know, this is pushed to migrate and all this capability, they're still growing the product and they haven't had a chance to even really build a partner ecosystem around it.
That's right. Yeah. And there's also a capabilities issue. And, you know, in the early days of Office 365, there were things that were possible on, say, SharePoint on-prem that were not going to be possible. Extensibility, especially, was one of the big ones I remember. In the cloud. And so,
well, the way they did those extensions was so unique to SharePoint that you basically made your career in SharePoint. If you could get that stuff in your head, that was your job.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a bad life, but that's what you became. And they sort of, then you realize like you couldn't care and feed those things long term. Like, I don't know how people retired. If you did all that custom work in SharePoint, like there was no way back.
Sure.
And the modern SharePoint online solution, it looks like web dev.
Yeah.
You could find people to do this now. And that's a little more, you know, if for me as a senior IT guy, I look at those customizations and I have much more confidence that I can sustain those over a decade or two. Where everything we ever did in those early versions of SharePoint was just horrifying.
Yeah, SharePoint was always really hairy. I have a feeling there are going to be SharePoint on-prem installs that are going to be like the COBOL of the, you know, the Y2K stuff. Like, they'll be around forever, like the cockroaches of the internet.
I went after guys like Carol Moon, who was doing the SharePoint migrations for Microsoft itself.
Yeah.
Moving Microsoft's own things to Office 365, which is great. Like, I'm glad that's happening. But he says it's like 93%. I says, so tell me about the 7%. He's like,
yeah,
dude.
Yeah, it's never going.
It's like, we're going to run this until nobody's using it anymore, and then we're going to turn it off. Like, that, there's no way it was built and what it does. And it's like, you have to make a new one or make that role obsolete. That's not going to run in the cloud.
That has to be very representative of what is happening or happened out in the real world as well. Right. And
yeah, I think Microsoft's numbers are arguably better than regular companies. Really?
Sure.
It is interesting. We've gotten to a place in the cloud, certainly in the conversation I've had, where it's like hybrid is forever.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, it's forever because everyone else is talking hybrid now, Google, Amazon, whatever, these companies that do not have a rich history on-prem, don't have any history really, are suddenly talking hybrid because that's the demand.
Yeah. Because the reality is they all have an on-prem entity, some certain amount of work, and a lot of it is Microsoft-related work, and it isn't going to move.
Yep, yep.
You're literally going to have to age it out, which in the enterprise world is a decade.
Yeah, that's right.
It is interesting, and it's challenging times. But yeah, from the software perspective, how we build software, what they're offering in the cloud, the Power BI and and the SharePoint Online, they're way more sustainable solutions. Like, they've certainly learned something off of all of the various on-premises incarnations they made over the years. As soon as Microsoft have to operate it itself on behalf of their customers, a whole bunch of stuff got fixed.
Right, right. I mean, it's a positive net change. The hiccup is getting there, right, for customers that did have the on-prem or do still have the on-prem stuff. But yes, once you make that leap, it's definitely a better, more sustainable world.
Yeah, and I'm still finding that the folks that are making the leap are making it because hardware is aging out, because data center contracts are coming due.
Yep.
There's all this CapEx expenditure coming up in organizations, and they got to look the CIO or the CFO in the eye and go, "Yeah, I need another 2-comma number to renew these." Or is that my budget for a migration to cloud, and that becomes a monthly expenditure?
Right, right.
So it's not, you know, funny thing is, like, it's not that the offerings are necessarily better, although they are. It's really that you have to wait for contracts to go, and that you're confronted with these expenses and these implementations. Say, what's worthwhile?
This life cycle thing is something that Microsoft should be familiar and comfortable with, and yet they fight it and fight it and fight it. And you see that a lot on the Windows side. I know that for enterprises, they have a long-term servicing branch or whatever, and they allow these things to go longer. But, you know, I was just thinking, it's 2019. Windows 10 shipped in 2015.
Yep.
That's 4 years ago. That's an interesting number. There are only one or two times in the history of Windows where that many years went by without a new version of Windows, you know, and
that new version was not that good.
That's right. There were extenuating circumstances,
yes.
but this is, we're an interesting time because I feel like there's a real vagueness to what the support timeline, is these days, especially on client. And Microsoft talks a lot about the lifetime of the device, which is not a clearly defined lifetime at all.
No.
You know, there may come a time, you know, a year or two from now, 18 months, whatever, where some version of Windows 10 comes out and it doesn't support XXX, whatever, chipset, Intel, AMD, whatever it is. And all of a sudden you've got PCs either as a person or in an environment that now can't upgrade to a new version of Windows 10. And that is not a problem then, but because versions of Windows 10s are only supported for a short period of time, relatively speaking, it will be a problem 18 months down the road or whatever the time frame is.
Yeah, it's not 10 years late from now. It's 2 years from now.
No, it's not 10. Right.
And so then the logical push then is that you better keep my hardware alive.
Yeah. I mean, everyone is talking about January 2020 because that is when Windows 7, which is, you know, the most popular recent version of Windows 10, expires from a support perspective. But the bigger date in many ways is when Windows 8 dies from a support perspective, not because it's popular, because it's not,
right,
but because it is the end of the line for that, right? And that's January 2023, which actually coincides with Windows 7 really in some ways, because they're going to support it for 3 more years through extended contracts for those enterprises that need it. So that's the kind of that's the real time frame, you know, for the divide between the past and the future.
The problem, of course, is they just stopped changing the main version number. Now we talk about 1803 and 1806 and 1903. Like, we're still getting new versions of Windows. It's just not.
Oh, right. But they're not supported for 10 years.
No, they're never supported for 10 years.
That's right? A major change.
Yeah.
And when Microsoft talks about where, you know, Windows is supported as a service, or however they say it, you know, Windows is not a service. It is absolutely supported like a service, and they are going to move you along.
Right. They're trying to support like a service something that is intrinsic to the machine.
That's right.
I mean, we still don't, you know, most people still don't buy Windows at all. It comes on the box.
But the reason this is a problem is, you know, when you think about the hundreds of millions of people out there who are still using Windows 7 and whatever that looks like when that support expires for them, the reason they still use it is because it just works. you know, and whether or not anyone needs a computer day to day, or they need one occasionally, or if they go to a local library or wherever they go to use a computer, that thing would probably just work for many, many years to come.
Yeah.
And that's on a 10-year support lifecycle.
Right.
You know, forcing people or companies or whomever to upgrade on a much more aggressive schedule is almost like a grand experiment that I don't really think has been fully tested yet.
No, it's almost certainly not. It's not going to be fully tested until, like you said, all those old OSs are off the market, are no longer supported. And this is not about features. This is about security, right?
Right.
I mean, that's what this comes down
to is just basic quality, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These things have to keep functioning. But, you know, as much as Win 8 is lasting till 2023, many versions of Win 10 are already out of immediate support, right?
That's right. That's right. I know. And that's the difference between the past and the present. It's a very stark difference. I don't think people pay attention to it enough, but it's going to suddenly hit them right in the face, because if you're using Windows 7, which is more likely, or maybe Windows 8 for a few of you, it is going to end.
Yes.
And then everything is going to be different.
Until Microsoft changes it, because a big enough customer comes along and says, no, you're going to keep that going.
Yeah, they have shown themselves to be particularly malleable to that kind of thing.
No, so, I think they often put out these statements to listen to the response as much as anything else. But it was when the U.S. Navy said, oh, no, we'll be still using XP and you will still be supporting it.
Right.
And
can't say no to the U.S. Navy.
Basically, yeah. And you just tell us what the price is. Like, you don't get to say no. You just have to give us a bill and then we'll argue about it.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah, the U.K. government came to Microsoft. I don't know if it was last year or the year before. That was a couple of years ago, I guess, when they had that hospital hack. And they said, look, you got to support this. What are you going to say? You going to say no to the U.K.?
Yeah.
You know, the answer is no. You say, of course you do it.
Of course you do it. And it's totally doable. It just costs money. Right? It takes people and time to make these fixes, especially when the fixes, you know, don't automatically retrograde. You come up with a solution, one version of the OS, and the other version of the OS can't use it. You have to find a different way to fix those problems. So.
Yeah. I don't want to get too far in the weeds here, but, you know, the other complexity is when you have a new version of Windows roughly every 3 years, and you have a 10-year life cycle, mm-hmm. support life cycle, you can pick any point in time on the calendar that you want. And you say, well, how many patch versions do we have to make for a particular vulnerability or whatever it is? And, you know, it's 2, 3,
right.
some number like that. Now look at the Windows 7 support life cycle and 18 months, whatever it is, pick a point on the calendar and say, how many versions do we have to make now? 5, 6, 7, you know, they've actually made it more complex for themselves.
Yeah. In some respects, they absolutely have. Yeah. And I understood what the goal here was, but I don't think they've actually delivered on, you know, in the sense that it was trying to make their support costs lower and easier so they could do more high quality stuff. I just don't know that it actually has worked.
I don't think anyone wants new stuff, for one thing. The thing that I think customers of Windows want is quality, whether they're businesses or individuals.
This is the thing I think is really interesting. Maybe the operating system as a whole is becoming less relevant in the sense that we don't care about them anymore. We just expect it to work. There once was a time where we cared what version of BIOS was on our PCs, right? And the kinds of microcode that were in our CPUs. And we just don't care anymore. The only thing we expect from it is that it works. We care about reliability and quality, nothing else.
Yeah. I mean, Windows is in a tough spot. I think that, you know, the most popular applications on Windows are the ones we all know and love. They've been around for decades in many cases, or they're web browsers and they open us up to that web app world. And a lot of the other things that people are interested in from kind of a computing perspective are happening on mobile devices now. And
right. Or they're just separate from the OS.
That's where the fun is. Yeah.
Right. And when they're on the web, they're from the cloud, they're from somewhere else, you don't expect it to be delivered as part of Windows anymore. We do. Yeah. In a lot of ways, we don't want that stuff delivered as part of Windows anymore because it represents instability.
Yeah. But the problem is you still have Windows, right? So Windows is this gigantic, hairy monster that's sitting underneath this couple of apps we're all using that aren't really that complex necessarily. And you still have to deal with every security vulnerability or bug or whatever it is that occurs in all of that code. Which, you know, suggests to me that maybe Windows evolves into something a little simpler and less legacy over time.
Well, and at the same time, you know, look at what the Windows team is actually doing with stuff like the Windows subsystem for Linux and the new Windows terminal and so forth. Is they're actually making Windows the place that you could talk to everything else with anyway. Like it becomes your hub.
I see that as, you know, it's almost a return to the days of workstations, you know, that Windows becomes the workstation, right? So for those people who need high-end design tools, Adobe tools, whatever they are,
right.
or engineering tools or software development tools. Windows, right? It's not going to make any sense ever, or maybe not for the foreseeable future, to do that on an iPad.
Right.
That's the world. Yeah, and that stuff that has more extreme requirements. Gaming, you know, if you're an extreme gamer.
Sure. The high-end video card and all of those kinds of things represent the reason you would want a workstation class machine.
Sure.
And then there's always going to be business for it. And in some ways, you know, those price points then bounce back up. You know, the thing I remember about just before the iPad came out, 2008, 2009, you know, was the race for the $500 laptop.
Yeah. Yep.
And it was a serious piece of crap.
Oh, like, yes.
They were all plastic. They were cheap as they could be. Like they were bad. And the iPad came along at $800 and just said, like, nobody's ever going to buy these laptops now. They're done. And the laptop price bounced back up and became nicer.
That's right.
And we got a quality machine.
I don't know what to make of this. I mean, in many ways, when you think about the PC market shrinking over the years, that's a big chunk of why. And, you know, even as recently as this past, I don't know, 3-6 months, whatever, Intel last fall warned about a chip shortage, CPUs for computers, specifically for low-end machines.
Right.
And the issue is that in the PC market, the companies that make PCs only make money on high-end computers, premium PCs, gaming PCs. And so they're over-ordering on that kind of stuff, and they're kind of underserving the volume part of the market. And so this is like I keep coming back to this term purpose-driven. When I think of the PC, it's not really a general tool for most people anymore. They have phones for that for the most part. Mm-hmm. It's more of a purpose-driven thing. Where again, you know, word processing.
Yeah, it's spreadsheets, and we talked about this. That there's classes of work where as soon as I have that problem, I'm like, well, I'm not going to do this here on my phone.
Yeah,
possibly even on my lap. I've certainly done that with my laptop too. And go, no, I'm going to wait till I'm on my big screen back at the office to do that work.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a creative professional or a scientist, an engineer, a developer, you don't mind spending a couple of grand or more on a really nice computer that's going to last you for several years and it has the power that you need to get your work done. But for the masses who are doing a lot of what they're doing on a phone, when they do need to turn to the computer, what they're really looking for is a screen and a keyboard.
Yeah.
You know, and that could be almost anything, really, when you think about it. Not that Chromebooks have taken over the world, but it does seem like a Chromebook-style machine would meet the needs of those people. Could be interesting in the enterprise, for sure. Simpler machine to manage.
I think the issue is identity, right? It's not that I'm not willing to use the other machine. It's that my stuff, you know, we tend to still put all our stuff in one place. And the floating identity between multiple devices just doesn't work that well for the average mortal, certainly.
Yeah, and that's actually a problem for Microsoft because they don't control the mobile end and can't offer a seamless experience around that.
They're trying.
Yeah, they are trying,
But then nobody else can offer the seamless experience either.
Well, Apple does a decent job,
honestly.
If you don't mind living in iCloud, I guess.
Yeah, in the Apple world.
Constraining, but they do have – it is seamless if you don't mind giving up your soul.
Yeah.
You know, right, which is pretty much the Apple marketing.
Yeah. It's the welcome to the walled garden. It's beautiful here, but you're never going to leave.
Right. It's a one-way dead-end street. You know, Google's trying to do that with Chromebook and Android, and that gets a little bit better all the time, but you know, whatever. But yeah, you know, Microsoft is sort of forced to reach out to these other platforms and see what they can do. It's going to be better on Android, but it isn't completely seamless.
Yeah. No, I put the Microsoft launcher on my Android device.
Yeah.
And put the new Edge with the Chromium engine on it and trying to see, can I bounce between these things? And it's rough. It's not that smooth.
It is rough. Yeah.
I don't know how you would do this inside of an organization and have confidence.
Right. I think the problem with a lot of this stuff and is that when you hear the ideas, they make sense. You say, yeah, no, I would like to be able to copy something to a clipboard on my phone and then paste it on my PC. That makes logical sense.
Right.
Or I want to access the documents I just accessed on my PC on my phone or vice versa. I want to see the websites I have open on my PC when I'm out in the world with my phone or whatever it is. You can invent all these little scenarios. They all sound like great ideas. But in practice, you know, at least for me, I find myself like, I don't really need that very often.
No.
And it doesn't work great. And because it's not completely seamless, I find myself not being super interested in
it. If it did work great, would you like it more? I mean, that's always the question, right? Part of this is it's not a seamless operation, so we don't want to use it very much.
I see Microsoft making some mistakes in the new Edge that they made in the old Edge, and this is on Windows 10 specifically, although the new Edge will be in a bunch of different places, which is, you're competing in a market that's well established. There are great players in the market, in this case, like Chrome and Firefox, that are really full featured. They have great extension systems and so forth. How do you differentiate, and there's some neat things you can do to make, font smoothing and smooth scrolling and have accessibility features that are very specific to Windows 10. And that's all very neat, but it's not super marketable. It's not super, there's no big demo you can do. And so they add these other features to the browser, which demo well. They're a lot like the things we were just talking about where you're like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Like tab management features where you can collect tabs together into groups and save them as a group. And you're researching for a paper maybe in school or as a journalist or whatever it is, and you want to call them back. And it's like, it's all this kind of complexity that ultimately
this sounds like 1 or 2% of the market, the same people that use.
Yeah. You just don't use it.
Bookmarks. Right.
But they're doing it again in the new one.
I think
the feature might be called collections. The idea is you're, looking online to buy a lawnmower or whatever it is. And you want to, put this stuff together into like a research dump somewhere. And it's like, guys, we already have OneNote. Why are you building
something else? Yeah.
Another thing to do the same thing.
The one thing I thought that was going to be great about the new Edge browser was the digital exhaust.
Yeah.
It was just this. Give me some control over what these web pages are making me admit.
Yep.
I don't know that they've done that.
I think that's going to be pretty successful. I mean, Microsoft has a great slide they can put up that says, here's the 300 and whatever Google things we removed from Chrome, which is hilarious. It doesn't have an asterisk at the bottom. It says, oh, by the way, we added back all of them, but for us.
This is my thought all along on this has been, Microsoft is the company that doesn't make money off of people's data.
That's right. Right. And which is how they should be marketing this, right? So the thing they announced recently at Build was this notion of, first of all, we're turning off the Google tracking. So that secret stuff where, you and I are having a conversation about a particular end table, and then all of a sudden I start seeing ads for that table when I'm browsing the New York Times or something. And it's kind of creepy and weird. And how do you explain that? And the way you explain it is Google.
Yeah.
All right. So that stuff's being taken out. That's neat.
And Facebook too.
Yeah. Facebook. Absolutely.
I've been doing that with a buddy for a while. Every time I go to lunch with him and I get him to pick me up at my place, I hop in his car and I talk about something we've never talked about before just to see.
And then all of a sudden.
Oh yeah. No, I went with radial arm saws the other day.
Yep.
Cause that's a talking point. Did this guy not have ads for radial arm saws in his Facebook feed the same day? Well, yeah. Yes, he did. Yeah.
That is just weird, right? No, it happens to me. I've written about this because it's not, people think, oh, it's a weird coincidence. No, it isn't.
Nope.
You talk about a surveillance state. My God, we don't have to move to China. It's right here. But Microsoft in the new Edge is saying, like, we're going to turn that stuff off too if you want, right? And it's really just an extension of what we have today with cookies and third-party cookies and whether they can follow you across sites and so forth. But if they can get that right, and like you said, they're the one company that doesn't make money off of your data, that's a marketing opportunity for them, and it's a win for consumers because I think a lot of people do want Chrome because of its compatibility, its performance, whatever. But they're a little leery of the Google thing.
Yeah. The rendering engine and the JavaScript engine are only a small part of a browser. It's this output that's the thing that's interesting. What's bothering me is still Microsoft's making decisions for me about how stuff should work. I would much rather have visibility into all that.
Right.
Give me a dashboard. Give me a dashboard for my kids.
They're getting there.
Yeah. But just you can decide what you want to turn off and what's being emitted. I mean, I know the one problem you're going to run into is wives finding out what their husbands are browsing. Like, that's going to be a bad day. But
I think we can all agree to that.
Oh, yeah. No, that's going to be a problem. There's no two ways that's going to be a problem. But at the same time, it's like, this is a button that can be pushed. And I like the idea that not all tech giants are automatically predatory, that we might actually have a kinder, gentler tech giant here that could have some help for us.
Yeah. I mean, we can, We can look at the reasons why this happened the way it happened. It doesn't matter in some ways, but in the world we're in today, mm-hmm. there are companies like Google and Amazon, Facebook, and that are just, their business models are broken.
Yes.
And I believe Canon probably will be regulated out of existence at some point. But here's Microsoft, this company with decades of relationships in the enterprise, and they've emerged somehow on the other side of this because they were a terrible company a long time ago. As the trustworthy company,
yeah.
right? They're the ones you can trust. That's yeah. beautiful.
And for the simplest reason of all, because you know where they make their money.
Yeah.
Like, and I have to wonder if that security dashboard ever comes into existence, like, wouldn't you pay $2 a month for that? Or make it part sure. of an Office 365 subscription? Which again, yep. it's like, I think we're also turning a corner culturally where it's like, I'm finally getting, if I'm not paying for the product, I am the product and I don't want to be the product anymore.
Yes. Office 360, this is kind of apropos of nothing, but it's really funny. I bet there is, on the consumer side especially, actually on the consumer side exclusively, probably more people who get Office 365 for the storage than they do for the apps. And that, you know, they almost see that. It's like, oh, and I get these apps too. You know, it's like, it's kind of goofy how that's evolved.
Yeah.
But yeah. In keeping with what you're saying, I mean, you could add that as a capability too. And it's like, yeah, that's great. You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, in some ways, Office 365 has become, you know, Windows 3. Remember when you had yeah. to buy the networking stack separately, right? Mm-hmm. You went out and you bought mm-hmm. Novell Network and stuff. And says, oh, no, we're just going to include that in Windows. Oh, we're going to include that in Windows. So now they keep including stuff in Office 365 for your six right. bucks a month. Oh, no, now you get this. And you also get this. And you also get this, which not yeah. a bad thing. And again, it's like, this is the kit we want you to pay for, and we're going to keep adding value to it.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, I think the thing you're actually describing is probably Microsoft 365 when you think
right.
about it, right?
Yeah.
It eventually just becomes this all-encompassing subscription, and it's beautiful for Microsoft because it's ongoing revenue,
yes,
pretty much guaranteed, regular, which is ideal for a corporation. And then for you, it's, you know, you get all these perks. It's like you have an Amazon Prime subscription. It's like, oh, I get a free music thing, that's cute. Or oh, they have like a movie thing, that's really neat. I mean, I only did it for the shipping perhaps,
right.
or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, Microsoft 365 could be like that for productivity, online safety, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, hopefully actually taking care of us to some degree, because we don't want to have to, I don't want to be a security expert.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. I'd rather have experts telling me these are our recommended settings and this is what it'll take away.
I think once you have that conversation, yeah, that's the PC right there. Right. That's the problem with the PC. It's
right.
just too much. I think most people, normal people, have had these bad experiences where they have to, they're reading a book or a magazine, they're looking at the screen like, is this lining up? You know, is this what I'm supposed to do?
Yeah.
And I think the simplicity of mobile devices, whether or not you're actually protected by them or not, I think is part of the appeal is just,
it's so hey, simple.
It just works.
Yeah. You know, I ran into this just the other day, taking my car in for service. Hey, look, the company that I get my car serviced through, the dealer, they now have mm-hmm. an online form. So, all right, I'd like my maintenance. And they had my car info there. That's good. And then they gave me a list of things. What thing would you like maintained? Like, how am I supposed to choose when I call in?
You can choose two of the three.
Yeah. I call in. I say, I'd like my car serviced. Get done what needs to be done. And they go, okay. Why are you offering me anything else? Like,
right.
What is it with software people creating complexity and calling it choice?
I know. So this world is changing. I mean, you know, and again, mobile is a big part of it. My son is in school for what back in my day would have been computer programming or
right.
you know, software development, whatever. Today, let me see if I can come up with the name. It's really funny because what they've done is you see this across the country, probably around the world, is they've created these degrees that are basically software development plus user experience plus psychology.
Okay.
And the point of it is you need to understand UI. Like, I don't know, you probably do this. I'm out in the world and I see bad UI everywhere.
Constantly.
And I always use this example of an ATM machine that was probably designed in the beginning when the card would, I don't know if it would stick out of it or something, but it actually has a message on the screen that says, don't take your card out of the machine. The card has been sucked into the machine.
Yeah.
I would have to physically destroy it to get my card back.
Yes.
And it's just like, why is this here? What is this superfluous message, you know? But there, you know, today we're training people, kids essentially, to be smarter about this stuff.
Right.
And, you know, when he went in originally, his degree was going to be from mobile app development, and he switched to this new thing. which is a broader area of expertise. But it's, again, it involves user experience as well as the psychology to understand how people think
right. When
they look at something. You know, it's smart.
It seems like a much, much more valuable degree. Like, that's going to carry him for a lot further.
You know, back in the day, it'd be some, you know, middle-aged goon from Microsoft with his own particular needs. And he's like, yeah, it's going to look like this.
Yeah.
You know, this is what I like.
Well, there was a time when Microsoft basically told us, this is what your app's going to look like, right?
Oh, yeah.
They just called it Office.
Yes. Right. And then they would just arbitrarily change it with every version so you could tell
which one. This is what your app's going to look like now.
Yep.
Very true. Well, friend.
Yeah.
I don't know where we got to. I was going to tell the show, like, does Windows still matter?
I know.
I think so. Just different.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I it's a good question. Like I said, I'm obsessed with this stuff. And I do think Windows still matters. It's a weird thing to say, but now that Windows is no longer the focus, I prefer the world it's in. I like this world better.
Yeah. You know what? I agree with you there.
And I think it's important to find that positivity, because a lot of people are freaking out. And honestly, I think it's a good thing.
It's not going to go away. And Microsoft is very customer driven in the fact that when you are angry, they listen. They respond. Yeah. I mean, you're happy to do too. But the bottom line is, like, if something's threatening your ability to be productive, you can usually push back and they'll find a way forward for you. But I think
it's a great customer service tip, by the way, because Microsoft really does respond
remarkably
to negativity.
Well. Yeah. For better or worse.
In our world, you know, we had just been to Build, and Microsoft briefs the press ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently some members of the press last year said, guys, you're telling us too much. We want to be surprised. So this year, they didn't tell us about four or five of the announcements.
Right.
And then they got a flood of complaints from people who said, what are you doing?
Well,
I need to know everything you're announcing up front. We don't want, if I wanted to be surprised, I'd come here as an attendee, you know, this is the way the company is.
Yeah.
They literally will react.
Mm-hmm.
Every time
they will try,
be sure to give your feedback.
Yeah, it's surprising. You know, I've never met anyone who actually called PSS, called the tech support service of Microsoft, that didn't say at the end of it, "I wish I'd called sooner."
Right. Exactly.
Right. They're actually stunningly good at what they do.
Yeah.
But you fight and fight and fight until you're inevitably furious by the time you're actually on the phone with whoever that person is.
Yeah.
And bless them how good they are at talking us down. And then they're really quite good at fixing things.
I mean, that first line of interaction must be the experts in human psychology. Like, can you imagine?
Oh, yeah. No, it's so they talk about psychological training. It's like everybody who phones here is in a state of insanity. And you got to unwind them.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's always fun and, you know, better than a real job, right? Could have been digging ditches.
Yeah, it's sort of a real job.
Well, your jobs is less real than most, but I think the average person listening to this is operating a set of gear, you know, take care of a bunch of people. And I hope they love their job, because I remember doing that job and thinking, like, it's really a cool way to make a living. And it is always new.
Oh, God, I think about this all the time. Like I said, I used to be in that world. It was that was my intention. I went back to school to become a developer.
Then you ruined it.
That is what I was going to do.
I miss it. Where did you go wrong?
Oh, I could tell you the exact time and date. No, it was, I don't know. You know, it's just the life does that to you. It kind of, it's like that bump-em car thing. You set out in a direction, and when you get to the other side, you're turned around and backwards, and you're actually right where you started. I mean, you don't know what's going on.
I cannot tell you how many times I've said, this is not what my high school counselor told me I'd be doing.
Exactly.
Paul, always a pleasure to chat. Fun show, if a little longer than the typical episode, but I think we had a lot to talk about, and it is challenging times. I think we need to check in regularly on this and just see where we are.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.